Okay, Backstage Bible, we're going to take a less than popular person on the forefront of the Bible, and we're going to look at, you know, what does this person say to us? So we've picked what I call the suffering woman. All right, the purpose of tonight is to look at this woman in Scripture, and as she makes her way through life, there's nothing new in her story. There's this trauma, there's this chronic issue going on in her life. And she's got to wrestle with that. She's got to figure out, how am I going to get past this chronic, ongoing issue in my life? She's going to need some sort of intervention. Something has happened over and over and over again, and something different has to happen to break her loose of this chronic issue. Now, sometimes we think things are acute and temporary, but in reality, the short-lived or the perceived short-lived issue becomes a chronic issue, and the chronic issue actually becomes a lifelong issue, a lifestyle issue, a lifestyle with a limitation issue. So sometimes the issues that we deal with in life we think will pass, and we even say to one another, this too shall pass. Well, sometimes they don't pass. Sometimes those things don't pass. They linger, and they turn into not just weeks, but months, and then they turn into seasons of life and years and decades, and that's what we find this woman tonight, dealing with an issue for 12 years. It's sort of defining her now. Now, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, I'm charged with the responsibility of talking about women here. I'm thinking of younger women. I'm thinking of college students who have been dealing with things in their life for a long time. Some of these things in our society today, young women are dealing with sexual abuse. Sexual abuse takes place in 25% of our population. Let's think about that. I'm thinking of young women today where, since Roe v. Wade, almost 55 million women have aborted their children. I just remember a few years back that number was 42 million. Now it's 55 million women. And with that comes things that you have to deal with emotionally and spiritually. And these are chronic issues that just don't go away. They kind of make themselves known and they linger in a person's life. You've heard me say before that 40% of first marriages end in divorce. In the mid-50s for second marriages, and third marriages in the 60 percentile category for divorces. Let alone fourth marriages, I can't even imagine maybe 80% failure rate. That look to be something I'm going to get over fairly soon, but apparently the patterns of behavior in our lives, we don't get over sometimes, and they become elongated, lifelong struggles. And that's what this woman has. She has a struggle. The sexual revolution in our society today has attached to it a number of stigmas and labels that cause women and men alike to have to deal somehow with that emotionally and spiritually and physically. So that's kind of the gist of it. How do we figure out how to cut off these chronic issues and end them and start out new? That's the question. All right, so what's the context of this poor, suffering woman? Well, the context is she's in a fishing village on the north end of the Galilee up there. Some of you have been there. You've seen it. A little town called Capernaum. And in Capernaum is a fish market, a temple, Peter's house. The Apostle Peter's house is there. There's some wonderful ruins there. You could go there today and really enjoy yourself. It's right on the water, a little fishing village. And Jesus has come to this village. And there are throngs of people in the streets of Capernaum. One 12-year-old girl, the daughter of the synagogue ruler by the name of Jairus, is quite ill and is dying. And Jesus is making his way through these throngs of people to get to this girl. Now, this town is not that big. This town is no bigger than the main street of our town. Small town. You could walk from one end to the other without too much trouble. Two or three blocks at the most. But with all the people in the way, he's being thwarted in his quest to get to this 12-year-old girl. Now, just so happens that this suffering woman who has been suffering also for 12 years. She's been suffering every day that this little girl's been alive, and she's suffering with an issue of blood, the scripture says. And she is not welcome. By Jewish law, she is not to even be in public. She is not to, because of her malady, her illness, and the stigma attached to it of uncleanliness, she's not to be among the people, in accordance with the Jewish law. She is, if you can imagine what this must have felt like, to be called ceremonially unclean. And that has all kind of ramifications to it. So that's the context. Now this seemingly anemic, one would think, woman is trying to make her way to Christ through this crowd that she's not supposed to be in. And her intent now is to not touch him, for touching him would make him unclean and would have all kind of ramifications for her. She seeks only to touch the hem of his garment. And in so doing, she believes that she will be restored physically in her body. Okay, so Mark chapter 5, this is what it looks like, verse 24 through 34. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet, instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in a crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, who touched my clothes? And that his disciples with him said, you see the people crowding around you, his disciples answered, and yet you can ask, who touched me? But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. And then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. Okay, let's talk about chronic suffering. Perhaps you know someone in your life, chronic, ongoing, uninterrupted at times, suffering. What does that feel like? You got to take the written word on a piece of paper or in your book, and you've got to go beyond that. You got to go between the lines. What's she feeling? What's she not feeling? How exhausted is she? What is the stigma? What is her self-esteem? What is her confidence level? All of these ramifications come in. Okay, this woman has, and perhaps you know people like this, chronic physical suffering. Subject to bleeding for 12 years. What is she mourning? She's looking back to a day and reliving the days when what? Reliving the days when she had vitality. Remembering the days when she had energy. When she had beauty. This cannot be a woman who thinks that she is beautiful. She can't be a woman who thinks that her appearance is attractive in any way. She can't think that. She can't feel that. She cannot think that she is accepted. She knows she's not. But even if people didn't know what was going on with this woman, they still would not accept her, even by her appearance. She's a woman in a man's world who's unclean, not welcome, socially unacceptable, feeling unattractive, and has no energy. This is what's going on with her physically. To have this self-concept of oneself that you are in no way attractive, in no way becoming to others, in no way acceptable to others, is a place that many women today live. They live in this perception, a created reality, that they're not beautiful. And why wouldn't a woman feel that way at times in the culture in which we live, that has placed an artificial standard of beauty in our culture that seemingly no one could attain to. What magazine cover isn't airbrushed, photoshopped? I mean, we've placed an unrealistic standard of beauty, outward beauty, on women today, and hers is only further magnified by her ailment. It's safe to say, she, like many women today, have a distorted concept of herself. I'm watching the internet the other day. I watch videos a lot. And there's this one experiment where some women were invited to a warehouse. And in this warehouse, they enter in, not knowing what they're walking into. They enter into this warehouse, and there they see a man with an easel. They don't realize it, but he's a former FBI sketch artist. And they enter in, and this man does not look at them. They only see his back, and he's at an easel with a blank white paper on it. And the woman is asked to sit behind him and to his right so he cannot see her, and between them is a drapery. And they are asked now to describe their physical appearance to this sketch artist, and he is drawing a picture of the woman based on her perception of her appearance. Then the woman leaves not having seen the picture. Another woman walks in who is a friend of the first woman who had described herself, and they now describe in detail chin, nose, eyes, lips, hair, face, fullness, lack of fullness, coloring. And the sketch artist draws a picture of the same woman through the eyes of a friend. And then the woman walks back into the warehouse, and unveiled in front of her are the two pictures, hers, her self-concept, and the concept of those who know her quite well. And it's amazing, as she looks at her own concept of herself, typically that woman will see someone who is closed down, lethargic, that lacks beauty, definition, that lacks vitality. Her eyes are sullen. She's magnified certain elements of her facial features to a negative extent. And then she looks at the perception of those who know her well, and she sees a much more vital, energetic, beautiful person. And we are naturally inclined that way to begin with. Now, this woman, rejected by her own religious leaders, unmarried, with this physical malady, with a lack of energy, and a poor self-concept, to move through a crowd is a very astounding thing in this culture, to see this happen. And she's dead broke on top of all of that. She has chronic physical suffering, no doubt, and probably a distorted self-image. Not unlike an anorexic who looks in a mirror at herself and sees herself different than she actually is. She sees herself much heavier than she actually is. A distorted self-concept. That had to be some of the qualities that are going on in this woman's life. The second thing about her is she had not only chronic physical suffering, she had, surely to go with that, chronic emotional suffering. Not only was she subject to bleeding for 12 years, she had, as the scripture says, she grew worse. She grew worse. Have you ever felt this? Have you ever had this experience like things are going bad and then they just get worse? What is worse for her? I mean, she's nearing death, surely. What worse for her is just unthinkable worse. Loneliness. Worse. Alienation, worse. She says that she grew worse. She has a loss of hope, loss of weight, loss of energy, loss of vitality, loss of beauty, loss of appearance, loss of self-confidence, loss of hope. She has women today, men for that matter, the sense of rejection when you lose a loved one. A love relationship, a dating relationship, a husband, a family member to death. either the death of a relationship or the death of a person, is this emotional struggle that goes on. And I've dealt with this over the years, women that have just lost their husband. This sense of, I got to get busy, I got to stay busy, I got to do things, I got to get going again, but yet that feeling of emptiness is still there. The busyness doesn't work. It's a temporary fix. Well, she has this loss of love, certainly, a loss of direction, a loss of confidence, loss of happiness. This is not a happy woman. Loss of purpose. And her emptiness is surely only growing as she's further depleted of her health. And then on top of all of that, the chronic physical struggle, the chronic emotional struggle, now she's got on top of that the chronic social stigma. Well, there it is. She's not brazenly moving through the crowd. She's hiding her face. She's not to be recognized. She's not to be there. She doesn't have the value to be there. You ever felt this way? You ever knew anybody that felt this way? That they did not have the right or the value to be somewhere, to be who they are. There's some people on this mountain that feel that way. They don't want to live. It's reality here. Well, she has a chronic social stigma that goes with it. Worse than that is the stigma and the label comes from her own religion. How could it be worse than that to be told by those you're supposed to look to for spiritual direction have defined her as less than? I'll tell you, the greatest abuse ever in a person's life and the hardest counseling assignment is the person that's been spiritually abused, who was had entrusted people to lead him or her where they needed to go, only to find that they were wrong. Now, this is the stigma she walks with. And on top of that, she has chronic financial lack. The scripture said, we just read it, she had spent all she had. I don't know if you know what that means. I know what that means. When you don't have anything and you spend it all, you're broke. You have nothing. And what's attached to poverty and lack? All kind of emotional things. This woman has more month than money. She has to be frustration. She's limited in what she can even think or dream or aspire to. She has no provision. She's reduced to the basic necessities and sustenance of maintaining life. She's reduced to those basics. There's nothing beyond that for her. Not really. If there was, it's a fantasy, for she has no funding. She has no provision. She has no care. She has no kinsman redeemer. She has no one paying for her way. She's nobody. She's as alone in Israel as you can get. She's as alone is in first century Palestine. There's no other aloneness. This is it. And it's lonely. She's trapped, really. She's stuck. She has not the ability nor the energy to work herself out of her situation. She really has nowhere to go, physically, emotionally, spiritually, or financially. And opportunities do not exist for this woman. She couldn't get a job if she wanted one. She's not to be hired. She's not even to be around anybody. No, she's not to be in anyone's physical proximity. Now, the last chronic thing she has is a chronic search for a solution. If she's got anything left, her energy is focused on this one thing, a solution. Not a temporary solution. A long-term solution. It says that she suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors. What does that say about her? She suffered under the care of many doctors. She has been in high pursuit of every opinion and every option available to her as long as her money would afford her those opportunities to seek and to find a solution, and has come up nil. She has none. Now, what do people normally do in these situations? Normally, what would happen in our society today, or maybe in any society, normally what would happen is you would try to escape your situation. I have got to escape this anxiety. I've got to relieve myself of this prevailing frustration. I've got to have a temporary vacation from my hopelessness. Now, how do you escape? People escape in many different ways. Some people get into physical relationships, sexual relationships. Other people get into new careers. Other people have geographical relocations. People move churches. People change friends. People seek out new opportunities. They get really busy. They can try to control everything in their life. I'm going to be in charge now. I've been the nail. Now I'm going to be the hammer. I'm going to control things. I'm going to get angry about stuff. I'm going to start calling the shots here. I'm going to get myself out of this situation. I'm not going to be hurt anymore. Other people fall into depression, and they hide under the covers. They take that warm blanket over them and say, it's all going to be okay. You know, it's not going to be okay in the fetal position under the blanket, hiding from the world. We know that. Rationalization. Or, in many respects, people look for a way out of their hopeless reality through spirituality. Spirituality, for many, can be an escape. Spirituality, Christianity, if there's any common ground between those two things, is not meant to be something that we hide from life, hide in from life. It's to be to where we go to receive life, to deal and to confront with the chronic issues that we have going on. Other people medicate. That's the way to escape. They medicate. Well, she doesn't have any of these options, apparently. So she's on a chronic search for a solution. So what does she do? Well, she had probably heard about this doctor and heard about that doctor and heard about this doctor. She had exhausted all of those options. Now she has heard about this figure, this person. This Jesus, she had heard about him. And she had heard, no doubt, that he was in Capernaum. My guess is she's not from Capernaum. Because if she was from Capernaum, she would probably have been easily recognized and ostracized and told to leave. But she had heard of this person, Jesus. And she rendered in her own mind, apparently, one way to have an intervention take place to stop this madness of this constant chronic problem is to intervene and to look for an option out. She chooses this Jesus. And with whatever she has in her, she pursues this Jesus at risk. Now she reaches out and she touches his clothing. She's immediately restored. I mean, oh my gosh, what is this like? Like, shock. Like, what would that be like? I don't know. All of a sudden, boom, everything's different. Everything was one nanosecond, it's one way. The next nanosecond, it's another. It's totally different now. And what that would have felt like on so many different levels, spiritual, emotional, intellectual, social, as a woman, as everything, as a concept of herself, has to change immediately like that. I don't even know that you could catch up with that kind of emotion in a few moments. I don't know that you could process that. I would liken that to what it was like for Adam and Eve, that one split second when all of a sudden sin had entered the human race, flooded with all kind of sense of guilt and shame and fear and hiding and remorse and weakness and folly and foolishness, just flooded with those experiences that had been so foreign to them. They had never experienced those before. It would take a while to process all of that. Well, she's on the good end of that transformation, but probably not having caught up to the transformation of really processing what all that's about. What a wonderful but yet perplexing place to be. And then Jesus, now this is interesting, he realizes something. Now, there is a, no doubt there's a lot going on here. There has to be a lot of noise. There has to be someone leading him towards this little girl to the house. There has to be throngs of people yelling, probably requests being made or worship being extolled or sung. It's public, really. It's like a big thing going on, amidst of a really hectic parade, and here she is, she touches him. But yet he realizes something. Now, I find this perplexing. He realizes that what? That power, some of your translations will say virtue, has left him. Now this is interesting, because apparently she touched his clothes while others were touching him, but she did it in a way unlike the others, therefore the result was different. One could gather that conclusion. He differentiated a draining of his power, this is interesting, to someone, not someone's, one. He knew that. Now, I also find it interesting that he didn't know who it was. I thought he knew everything. He seemingly did not know specifically who touched him, so he turned around and asked, "Who touched me?" So he's not differentiating between people in the throngs around him, but he is saying that there is someone who has received something of him into them, not knowing. Now, he doesn't distinguish male or female. He simply turns around and does not know who it was. Very interesting, and quite bizarre, actually. Therefore, he does distinguish between individual needs, yet at this moment, apparently, he does not know to whom he has blessed. Said another way, Christ has imparted power to a person unawares. I don't know that you could draw a conclusion other than that. Unaware of to whom he has imparted power. Therefore, his power was available to all, but received by one. Can't distinguish who it was, but something different about that one, seemingly different than all the others. Therefore, the power was imparted to that one person, the woman. He was not decisively aware of who initiated that process. Now, this ought to mess up your theology a little bit. I thought the impartation of power from God to an individual was initiated with a request from a person in a verbal sense. I thought that prayer was a two-way communication whereby one person made a request of a divine power, the divine power, having heard that request, made in faith, in his sovereignty would impart power to that person as a result of the request. But none of that is going on here. Apparently not. His power, not only him, but the power upon him and in him does not differentiate. Now here's what's happening. This is so crazy. If you knew your Old Testament background, what is happening in this 1 second is so profound. The Old Testament law that says you're not supposed to be in the street, you're unclean, you're not to touch another person, you're not supposed to even be here, is meeting in a second's time grace. Grace that says, you don't deserve this, but I'm going to give it to you. It's a gift. Receive it. It's a grace so profound, it doesn't even differentiate those who receive it as to what they have or have not done. For he's not even aware of what she has or has not done. It is a full grace coming right up next to the letter of the law. The two meet in an instant. And I think it's beautiful that he doesn't know who touched him. I think it's fantastic he didn't know what they did or did not request of him. Because that's what grace does. Grace doesn't differentiate. Grace only is imparted to people with faith. And she had that. She could not perform. She could not earn. She could not meddle. She could not manipulate. She couldn't do anything. In fact, she did in silence. In her own silent world, by faith, grace imparted power to her and she could do nothing about it. Nor could she do anything not to deserve it. And that's the fullness of grace. She didn't do anything in that moment to merit God's love and favor, nor did she do anything that would hinder God's love or favor. She just was there. She just believed. Which brings up an interesting point. Every person in the throng around Christ was in close proximity to him, but only one was in his presence. Only one in his presence received the fullness of joy. Every other person was in close proximity and received apparently nothing. Question. If you're suffering, or you know someone who's suffering, have they asked for that suffering to be relieved time and time and time again? Yes. Sure they have. Next question. Why have they not received? Don't know I know the answer. But I do know in part, if that person, myself included, can be more enamored to worship reverentially in the presence of God, regardless of what he will or will not do, in a manner that transcends a trivial request, if I can come into the presence of God and worship and reach out to touch him, I don't have to ask for anything. Because he by nature is power. He by nature is love. He doesn't conjure up love to give. You simply come into his presence and reach out to him, and love is there. And if we've made receiving something from God simply on the basis of request, the depth of the request, the earnestness of the request, the frequency of the request, the persistence of the request, we've missed in proximity to God his presence, capital P now, his presence. That is sufficient, his presence. You can pray every day. You can have a devotion every day. You can sing songs every day. But you can be in proximity to God, not in his presence. There is seemingly, based on this account here, this narrative, there is a difference. You can wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning in the midst of your physical, emotional, spiritual, financial suffering. You can get on your knees near the headboard of your bed. You can grab onto those things and you can pray for a couple reasons. To satisfy your own personal desire that you did so. Or you can put aside every agenda other than to enjoy his presence. There's a difference. This woman apparently tapped into something that no one else that day did. And as a result, her suffering ended that very second. Find it interesting. There's something unique going on there. Law met grace, and grace won. Because she sought to touch the hem of the garment of the one, the only one, who fulfilled all law. Therefore, she didn't have to. She fulfilled the law she was breaking. That's amazing. To be in the presence of the one who fulfilled the very law she's breaking. She had nowhere to go but up when she touched the hem of his garment. He had already fulfilled her lack before she ever received the benefits of it. Interesting. Power is available without having to ask. That ought to mess you up. That ought to wreck your thinking. And frankly, I mean to. Power is available without having to ask. It just is. And isn't that what Yahweh is? He just is. Exodus 3:14, Moses says to the God on Sinai, I'm going to go down this mountain. I'm going to talk to these people. 3 and 14. Who shall I say sent me? The only answer God, only God could answer this way. No man would ever think of this answer. I am that I am. Tell him that I am sent you. So he does. Only God would answer that question that way. Man would never conjure up that answer. The I am is available to you and I every second of every day, whether we're suffering or not. And there is a presence, a consciousness, an awareness that we have to enter into when we reach out to him that yields us incredible blessing, the presence of God. Now, said another way, God is omnipresent. So every essence of every piece of air in this room, every piece of matter in this room is full of the presence of God. There isn't one synapse in your brain, nor is there any space between any molecule in the air in which I'm speaking where God's presence is not. He's omnipresent. The difference is we can be in proximity to his presence, but not in his presence, meaning we cannot be aware of his presence. So when you come to church or you start to pray at night or you're going to read your scripture, whatever you're going to do, there is a presence that you can become aware of that was there the whole time. You're just now aware of it because you've entered in with his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Because you've entered in confession, because you've reverently entered in, you've shed your own limitations, and as she did that day, and she entered into his presence, not his proximity. There is a difference. And that too will mess some of your theology up, but it is the fact. It is true. We are always in his presence, but not always aware of his presence. Sometimes you've been in a worship service that it just seems like something has taken place and people are now aware of the tangible presence of God. We've entered in, you see. Well, she did that. Others did not. And she fell at his feet. And she trembled. And she told him everything that ever happened to her. This is fascinating to me. This now whole woman, this now beautiful woman, this now restored woman, this now revived and refreshed woman, is standing in a street talking to a man she still has yet to touch while throngs of people are trying to escort him to a 12-year-old who's dying. And Jesus stops everything. Stops the momentum of the crowd, and he looks at the woman, and he listens to her tell her whole entire story. While the breath is leaving the young 12-year-old girl who's been alive the whole time the story was experienced. What does that mean? Christ is the high priest. And for a high priest to touch that woman, to listen to her story, is synonymous with the Old Testament law of a priest declaring her clean again. And by doing that in the street, he has restored her socially, intellectually, physically, and spiritually. Of course she'll go to the priest and be declared clean because she is clean. But he took her and valued her in that moment. So what do you say? What do you say to the young woman with the chronic in the back of her mind issue of abortion? What do you say to the young woman who's been sexually promiscuous and when it's quiet and no one's talking and there's not a lot of distraction, she realizes that reality. What do you say to the person who suffered so long and so much? No answer has come. What do you say? What do you say to the person who's nearing bankruptcy, is out of money, and has nowhere to turn? I don't have all the answers, but I know this one. seek not the proximity, but the presence of God. And in his presence is the fullness of joy. And I'll end with this. Having just done the funeral of a 71-year-old man who suffered from Parkinson's for 33 years, nearly half his life. I can't explain this, but I know there's some truth in it. It would appear as though some people are called on this broken, tattered earth in our lost state to suffer for the glory of God somehow. That in some people's suffering is a unique, God-ordained special occasion in which God can be glorified in a manner that cannot take place in another person's life because of the absence of suffering. Now listen to this. This will mess you up as well. Philippians 3 and 10, I want to know Christ. So far, so good. I want to know Christ, and the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings. Becoming like him unto death. So somehow, to attain to the resurrection from the dead. On this earth, in our fallen state, some will suffer, and it will be chronic. It'll be a lifetime. Suffering will end where? In the full presence of God. But in that parenthetical time period of your life, that suffering is somehow a unique opportunity, I can't explain it all, in which one can glorify God in the suffering. And when Jesus says to those boys that day, come follow me, he may have meant more than I'm going down the road to the next town. He obviously meant more because many of those he spoke to followed him to their death on a cross in various ways, impaled by swords, burned at the stake. When he says, follow me, to some, I don't understand why there's a suffering. You say, how can a loving God allow some people to suffer? Well, I don't have the vantage point, and nor do you, to conclude based on this one speck of time in all of eternity what everything is all about when you have all the rest of eternity in which to figure it out. All I know is some will suffer. All I know is blessed are those who are persecuted and insulted, and all kinds of falsehoods are said about you. There's something about it. But for this woman, there was a profound difference between proximity and presence. And apparently such a profound presence to a suffering woman that there was no need to ask. To ask in that moment would have somehow cheapened or diluted the presence and would have put him in harm's way. Well, there you have it. If you're suffering, move towards the presence. Don't move towards a concept. Move towards a person. Don't move towards a theology or a doctrine. Move towards a divinity. Don't move into an understanding of knowledge. Move nearer to Jesus Christ himself. By faith, you just need apparently a mustard seed. Move towards his presence. Though you may be exhausted, though you may be broke, though you may have a social stigma and label upon you, and though you may have unforgiveness and bitterness and resentment and all those things in your life, move towards his presence in your heart. He'll meet you there. You may not even need to ask.